have the Klein and others, because he got kind of conned into a thing with the Bishop Joseph Maria Roper. His real name is Bert Roper. Maybe you know him.
I do, yes.
Do you think he's ballot enlisted, or what's
his name? I have any doubt about it. Absolutely. He certainly is, yes. He's had a terrible lot of worry about it. He was up there the other day at the conference of priests up in Chicago, but he hasn't got many means. He has not much money, of course, and he said he couldn't possibly come out again. It cost him about $500 to come over. He had to get some small stipend there for a living. But he's a good, sincere little man. Yes, there's no question at all. He's a valid patient. He doesn't need to exercise it. I don't think, really, that he was the sort of man that should have been made a bishop. He's too, he's not quite rugged enough for the battle, you know. But he's nice. He's a good little man, you know.
No, only what I was told of him. I've never seen him personally.
Oh, he's all right. Oh, he's a nice little fellow.
Oh, I understand he's been reconsecrated several times.
Well, he's been conditionally consecrated. This was the problem I don't know exactly why, but the fact is that if he was reconsecrated, well, but when we say reconsecrated, we mean he's conditionally consecrated. The fact is that there wasn't any doubt about it, I would say, from the bishops. Probably the first one was perfectly valid.
You know the different lines he's gone through, who all consecrated him and reconsecrated him?
No, but he has told me. He has told me, but I don't have a doubt, I couldn't give you that. But the bishop is, he said, there's no question about it. I think this is right, what he said. He sent me a thing the other day. I've seen him a few times. He sent me a copy of his bulletin the other day, which was really very nice. I thought it was quite solid Episcopal sort of stuff, you know. And he's only got this tiny little place. I think he's got two chapels where he is. And he lives a very secluded life. But I have written to him once and just told him not to worry about whether he's a bishop. But he is a bishop. I mean, he knows he is, and I believe that he is. I wouldn't have any doubt about it personally. The thing is, he doesn't need to. It doesn't need to exercise his biscuitry at all. Really, maybe he could confirm. I don't know whether he does. I suppose he does. But I think he could certainly do that. As far as that goes, anyone can confirm in certain circumstances. I used to confirm on various occasions, both as parish priest and also as chaplain to hospitals. That was a faculty that was. Given that it's a pretty wide open faculty, and it was set down in the faculty sheets of the dioceses. It's always there, and it was a faculty, because a bishop can't possibly confirm everyone, and although confirmation is not absolutely essential, it is nevertheless a very useful sacrament in many ways, in that it confers further grace. There's a special grace, and it also confers the great help of strength and perseverance and things like that. It's a valuable, valuable sacrament. And to Catholics, equal in other respects, are not equal if one has received the confirmation and the other's not. It was a sacrament that was instituted by my Lord for a very special purpose. So that I would think that to be about the only way in that anything that he would exercise was confirmation, which strictly belongs to the bishop. But of course, that the bishop can't give, or the right to an ordinary priest to confer holy orders. Or I think there's some talk about it having been done once or something like that. But normally speaking, it just can't be done. It requires a validly consecrated bishop to confer holy orders. And a fortiori, I would say, the episcopacy. Yeah.
Well, do you know how much area of jurisdiction supposedly this bishop, Joseph Maria Roper, has? You say he's a valid listed bishop. Does he have any jurisdiction, or what?
I suppose he would have jurisdiction, but he doesn't try to exercise, really. I mean, unless a man says, I'm a bishop and this is what I'm saying, you have to do it. He's not exercising. I don't think he wants to exercise jurisdiction. But it hurts him all the same. He's quite convinced that he is validly consecrated, and he finds it's just that he finds it very difficult to stand up to the opposition that he gets from certain quarters about this thing. I think that's the big problem with him. But he's a good man, and he's a good priest. He's a holy little father, a very good man. And I've got no problems with him at all. But he doesn't want to come out and throw his weight around. He doesn't want to do that. He's quite happy where he is. But it's just that he gets needled all the time and provoked by certain people and say, your orders are invalid, or at least your power of consecration. Consecration is invalid. He did actually ordain one priest, Father De Kesel. Well, he's a man that's gone off the deep end, a crazy fellow, really. I know him fairly well. He was working here under Bishop Musi. But then he went off. He was a very proud fellow. He'd been married. Not that there was anything wrong with that, but his wife is still alive, and I think they had some sort of a separation, and eventually it was thought that he was a good enough material for ordination, and he was ordained, and now he's up in Illinois, and went and had himself consecrated by some bishop, some old Catholic bishop, as far as I know, up in only a few months ago, maybe what? Oh, 12 months ago. It might be just a fraction, a little more than that. He went up to Canada somewhere and had himself consecrated. He came back and made himself the primate archbishop of the United States and Mexico. Halfway there, but he's a strange man. Only at 44. Yeah. But anyway, there's no, I don't think, it's not an issue as far as I'm concerned with Father Joseph Maria. Is what he signs himself as, Father Joseph Maria. Well, I think he uses the plus sign in front of him, which he's got a right to do. I would do the same if I were in his position. Because he is a bishop, I'm sure of that, and therefore he is.
But you know, you say you're sure he's a bishop, but do you know who consecrated him to make him such? I guess you don't remember that.
Well, no, I don't know. I think his consecration. Oh, I've got it somewhere, but I can't remember that stuff. I read it and I just get the impression, I take the message away in my mind that this thing is valid. And I think he was only consecrated twice. Or the second time, Protestant, conditionally.
And there's quite a bit more information about Joseph Maria Robur, but if you want some of it, an interesting article, an informative article, is Dryden's Notes on Robur, of the way I've recently heard the Reverend Thomas C. Fooey tell us he thought Joseph Maria Robur, Bert Robur, was only consecrated twice, which means the first time was coming the third time removed by an angel, and the Catholic teaching is that angels can never effect a sacrament. They may be able to dispense it as the angel of Portugal distributed Holy Communion, but they can never consecrate. So that means that sacrament was not valid. The second way we know that Bert Robur received supposedly consecration as a bishop was through this Bishop Burley in England, and we realize he was very much mixed up with these women deaconesses, priestesses, bishopesses. And we also know the Catholic teaching is that no woman can ever be ordained, so that's one of the greatest impediments. They can never be validly consecrated a bishop, so that kind of outrules it. Leaves another evident contradiction. But now let us turn to tracing back the line of succession for Bishop Francis Conrad Schuckardt. And now let us hear the voice again of Bishop Schuckardt from his question and answer period talk at the San Diego Seminar 1983.
The Roman Catholic Church, which had its origin in the tribes, kept no careful records of the non-ordinations of every other priest and bishops. The most careful records kept by any church anywhere. And at the time I didn't understand it because that's origin of others, but now I reflect upon it, I can see that the absolute certainty of the limited orders which I had, because I was consecrated by a bishop who had been consecrated in the order of the Catholic Church.
I'm skipping a little bit of the tape now to pick him up at the end where he kind of sums up what he's been saying.
It was a great relief to my mind and heart and soul that I received orders through an apostolic succession which I can be absolutely certain about.
And now that Bishop Francis Schuckardt has told us that the Church of Utrecht has kept the most careful records of anyone in the world, and that he's absolutely certain of the validity of his orders, I will give you his line of succession. Please try to remember the names of these men, and I will also give you the date they were consecrated. You probably already know that Bishop Francis Conrad Schuckardt was ordained a priest October 31st, 1971, receiving all the minor orders in Tonsure that same day. And the very next day, November 1st, 1971, consecrated a bishop, all these orders received by this Bishop Daniel Quitter Brown. And now I read from a letter of 1974 signed by this Bishop Daniel Q. Brown. And he tells us in this letter that I was ordained to the priesthood on May 14, 1967. I was consecrated bishop on September 1, 1969 at St. Augustine's Pro Cathedral in Brooklyn, New York. My apostolic succession is traced in an unbroken line back to the Roman Catholic Church. My consecrator, Archbishop Hubert Rogers, was consecrated by Bishop Carmel Henry Cafora on July 30, 1942. Bishop Kafar was consecrated on October 4th, 1916 by Bishop Delandis Burgess, who had been consecrated on June 29th, 1912 by Bishop Arnold Harris Matthews. I interrupt his letter here to state, he says, June 29th, 1912. That must be a typographical error because Prince Delandis Burgess was consecrated on July 29th, 1913. Going on with Daniel Q. Brown's letter, Bishop Matthew was consecrated on April 28, 1908 by Archbishop Gerardus Gull, Archbishop of Utrecht. Archbishop Gull's succession goes back in direct line to the Roman Catholic Church. I can provide Archbishop Gull's complete lineage to anyone who requests it. And since we heard the voice of Bishop Francis Schuckardt telling us that this old Roman Catholic kept the most perfect records of anyone in the world, then here's another evident contradiction. Daniel Q. Brown states he was consecrated by Archbishop Hubert Augustine Rogers, which I assume is the correct man who consecrated him. But we have then people who should know the Marianite Old Catholic Church, Province of North America. And I have a photocopy of this letter dated October 14th, 1977, just to John M. Templin. And this letter in one paragraph reads, in regard to Schuckardt, we are true old Catholics. We do not recognize him or his priest as being either Roman Catholic, which they claim, nor as old Catholics. Daniel Brown, we only know of by name, but we had heard he was, quote, consecrated, unquote, by, quote, Bishop, unquote, Damien Hughes of California, and so this line of the old Catholic Church could not even find out who had consecrated Daniel Q. Brown. I have another article here written by the Reverend Anthony Cachada, a warning on the old Catholics, false bishops, false churches, and he's done a very lot of research, put together this paper. Toward the bottom of page 4 it reads, another which occurs quite frequently is that of a certain Bishop Daniel Q. Brown. He seems to have been consecrated by Martina at some point, and consequently performed a number of consecrations himself, including that of Francis Shepard. Here again, he had access to a lot of information, but he was not able to find out who consecrated Daniel Q. Brown, except they kept such good records. Let us go through this line of succession again. And now I take my information from this very well documented and researched book, Bishops at Large, by Peter F. Anson. On page 172, we find the information that on the morning of April 28, 1908, Archbishop Gull consecrated this Arnold Harris Matthews as a bishop. The ceremony took place before the high altar of the old Catholic Cathedral, St. Gertrude, Utrecht. Goes on to give this information. The historic, and I interrupt to say that is a very important word, the historic continuity of the apostolic succession thus imparted cannot be questioned. It can be traced back in an unbroken line to the nephew of Urban VIII, Cardinal Antonio Barberini the Younger. And here it gives the line of succession up to this Bishop Farlet, who was the main spoke in this whole wheel, even through Matthews. Farlet is the one who broke away from the Catholic Church. This happened on October 15, 1724. And so we see that there are 247 years and 15 days of people not having any jurisdiction, authority, or office in the church that Francis Conrad Shepard came through. And to prove his orders to be valid, then you have to trace back his 247 years and 15 days and know that each and every one in that line of succession used the proper matter, form, and intention. And now to give some history that I was never able to find out when living in Shepard's community of Mary Immaculate, Queen of the Universe. This Bishop Arnold Harris Matthews was born on August 6, 1852. He was baptized with Catholic rites in France, but 2 years later, to satisfy his mother's scruples, he was conditioned to be baptized by an Anglican clergyman. He attended both churches without distinction, and went on oscillating between Rome and Canterbury for the rest of his life. In January 1876, he was admitted to St. Peter's Seminary, Patrick's Hill, Glasgow, having been hurried through his philosophical and theological studies in about 18 months. He was ordained priest on June 24, 1877. Dr. Matthews spent only 10 months as curate of St. Andrew's, Glasgow. He soon found that it was not his vocation to be a secular priest in Scotland. By June 1878, he had become, quote, Brother Jerome, unquote, having entered the Dominican novitiate at Woodchester Priory near Stroud, Gloucestershire. He made his simple profession on June 5, 1879, but was dispensed from these vows before the end of that year. And Peter Anson goes on to explain how Matthews was never stable. The longest period he ever stayed any place was 10 years. And that's not now, it was after he was living as a layman again. But one of the churches Matthews hooked up with was the Unitarian community. And he was now ipso facto suspended from the Catholic priesthood. And so he decided to offer his services to the Church of England. And while messed up in this church, we're told that meanwhile Arnold Harris Matthews had fallen in love, unable to resist the charms of Miss Margaret Duncan, the fifth daughter of Henry Duncan of Toronto, Canada, It was not long before they were engaged on February 22, 1892. The rector of Holy Trinity, the Reverend Robert Eaton, performed the marriage of his self-unfrocked priest curate with this lady. And then he goes on to tell some other sad things in his life, which brought about his ending his association with the Church of England. And at that time, Arnold Harris Matthews reverted to a lay status. So his next adventure, so it appears, was helping to establish the Zoological Gardens at Brington. Goes on to tell us, though, that he regained his faith and once more firmly believed all that the Holy Catholic Apostolic Roman Church believes and teaches, and rejected and condemned whatever she rejects and condemns. So far as Matthew's peace of mind was concerned, this was awkward, because now he had to face the fact that he had incurred the penalty of excommunication by presuming to contract what in the eyes of the Church was merely a civil marriage, thus putting himself in the category of moral cases reserved to the Holy See. No priest in any part of the world, on his own authority, could give him absolution, nor could the sinner receive Holy Communion, far less start celebrating Mass again, as he longed to do. And then the book goes on to explain many other sad incidents in his life, how he kept changing around from church to church and writing different articles, first defending one church and then condemning it, and defending another church and condemning it, and so on. As we said, he was consecrated a bishop on April 28, 1908, and then he started causing so much trouble that His Holiness Pope St. Pius X formally excommunicated Arnold Harris Matthews together with two priests, Hubert Ignatius Beale and Arthur William Horwath, on February 11, 1911, and St. Pius X not only excommunicated Matthew, but called him a pseudo-bishop and declared him vetandus, a term in church law which meant that Catholics were subject to censure if they had anything to do with Matthew. As Peter Anson goes on to tell us, that later Matthew raised himself to the status of metropolitan and adopted the title of Old Catholic Archbishop of London. And Matthew later went on to regard himself as subject to no higher authority, and he regarded himself as also a pope. On page 180, we find that Arnold Harris Matthews defended his consecration of these two priests who were excommunicated together with himself by St. Pius X, with the explanation that it was virtually important to secure the old Catholic Church in England against the loss of apostolic succession. Please note that this is a very, 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 very important point about this apostolic succession. You'll find that all of these schismatics claim that they have apostolic succession. But now allow me to please read to you from a book titled The Pillar and Ground of the Truth by the Reverend Thomas E. Cox, Chicago, 1900. Has an imprimatur by Bishop Patrick A. Feehan, copyright 1900 by the Reverend Thomas E. Cox. And this book is, again, very well written and documented, but what I need to turn to is page 173 and then flip over to page 174. And it reads that those have lost the line of valid ministers leading back to apostolic times cannot plead the possession of apostolicity. Where there is no ordination, no priesthood, no authority, no power, apostolicity is out of the question. And so if one does not have authority in and of the Catholic Church, he is not in the true church. He has no apostolicity in his line of succession anymore. If one has no power, which means no jurisdiction, then they cease to have this fourth characteristic mark of the true church. Now let me turn to what St. Thomas Aquinas says and the supplement, question 22, article 3, where he says, I answer that jurisdiction can only be used in relation to another man. Consequently, since every excommunicated person is severed from the communion of the faithful, he is deprived of the use of jurisdiction. We also know from the teaching of St. Thomas Aquinas and later on in canon law that every apostate, heretic, and schismatic is ipso facto excommunicated. Now let us go on to read the next sentence of Father Cox in The Pillar and Ground of the Truth, published in 1900. Even if valid orders exist where jurisdiction is lacking, there is no real apostolicity. Schism as well as heresy destroys apostolic succession. To make certain we understand that, even if valid orders exist where jurisdiction is lacking, there is no real apostolicity. Therefore, even if valid orders are coming through this line of the old Roman Catholics up to a certain point, or maybe even they did come through clear up to Schuckardt, this can never be proven one way or the other. One thing is proven, though, there has been no apostolicity since October 15th, 1724. They simply do not have this fourth mark of the Church. As well as we can prove from this book, they do not have any of the four marks of the Church. So let us review again these three sentences from The Pillar and Ground of the Church by Reverend Father Cox. The line of valid ministers leading back to apostolic times cannot plead the possession of apostolicity. For there is no ordination, no priesthood, no authority, no power. Apostolicity is out of the question. Even if valid orders exist, where jurisdiction is lacking, there is no real apostolicity. Schism, as well as heresy, destroys apostolic succession. Unquote. So let us keep this very much in mind when we consider that all of those clerics who went into public heresy by signing the heretical decrees of the Second Vatican Council, such as Paul VI, John Paul I, John Paul II, Archbishop Lefebvre, Archbishop Tooke, and most often ciliary bishops, they then under Canon 188, Section 4, lost their office, their jurisdiction, their authority. Although they have valid orders, at least most of them probably do, they no longer have this fourth characteristic mark of the Church, apostolicity. They're not members of the true Church, outside of which there is no salvation. And if they're not members of the true Church, then they are members of a false Church. And let us review then what the true Church teaches us through Canon 1258. It is in no way allowable for the faithful in any active way to attend or take part in the religious functions of non-Catholics. But now I will go back again to this book, Bishops at Large by Peter Anson, to get back from this digression and trace out again the line of succession that Bishop Francis Schuckardt comes through. And so back now to Arnold Harris Matthews. As I think I've mentioned already, but on page 192 it says, having raised himself to the status of a supreme pontiff of a universal church, he felt it his duty to plant his new organizations in many other countries. In other words, Matthews himself made himself the Pope. And it goes on to tell how he made one of his biggest mistakes in his life by raising to the episcopate a nationwide known homosexual. And it tells us on page 194 that in September 1914, Prince Bishop de Landis Burgess had left England for the United States with the connivance of the Foreign Office. And on page 197, it tells us that on January 12, 1915, Bishop de Landis Burgess, whose titles and aristocratic manners may have assisted his acceptance in the Episcopal Church, assisted at the consecration of Hiram Richard Jose as Bishop of Cuba. This missionary district had been erected in opposition to the Metropolitan See of San Cristobal de Habana, founded in 1787. So without his authority, Matthew's old Catholic line of succession found its way into the Protestant Episcopal Church, giving a member of its clergy the belief that the orders were valid in the eyes of Rome. And so here we should consider whether this Bishop Prince de Landis Burgess was an Episcopalian or an old Roman Catholic at the time that he conditionally reconsecrated Cardinal Henry Caffora to trace that up to Bishop Francis Shepgard. And now I come over to page 199, where it gives a little bit of only part of the history of the many different names that Matthews called himself in the many different churches he founded. Quote, after his complete breach with the old Catholics of Holland in 1910, I ask you to note he already broke with Holland before he consecrated Prince de Landis Burgess in 1913. Going on, Matthew described himself as, quote, Catholic bishop, unquote, or again as, quote, Bishop of England and Ireland of the English Catholic Church, unquote. A few weeks later, quote, the Western Orthodox Catholic Church in Great Britain and Ireland, unquote. Shortly afterwards, the title used is, quote, Archbishop of London, unquote. In March 1911, the title is, quote, Archbishop and Metropolitan of the English Catholic Church, unquote. This became, quote, the Catholic Church in England, Latin Unionite branch, unquote. And 2 months later, quote, the Catholic Church in England, Latin and Orthodox United, unquote. It goes on, but shows how changeable Matthews was in changing his own name and how many different churches founded with so many different names. I'll just read what Peter Anson gives here in the index under the churches of the Matthew succession, starting on pages 323, section A. Old Roman Catholic Church, Western Catholic Unionite Church, now known as the Old Roman Catholic Church of Communion with the Primarital CN Cluster Glow. Old Catholic Church in Ireland, English, Old Roman Catholic Rite, Old Catholic Orthodox Church, Liberal Catholic Church, the Church Catholic, Independent Catholic Church, renamed Apostolic Service Church, and Old Catholic Orthodox Church. The Old Catholic Evangelical Church of God, Old Holy Catholic Church, Church of the One Life, Free Anglo-Catholic Church, Old Roman Catholic Church, English Rite. And overseas, he gives some name here in, I believe, French, then Old Catholic Church in America, known later as Catholic Church of North America, and Orthodox Old Catholic Church in America, North American Old Roman Catholic Church, Old Catholic Church in North America, Old Roman Catholic Church in North America, Universal Episcopal Communion, Universal Christian Communion, Independent Episcopal Church in the USA and Canada, Diocese Victorate of Niagara Falls, Mexican Old Roman Catholic Church, etc. And I gave this for one reason, because the Reverend Kevin Hughes, probably his father, Mary Benedict Hughes, and Bishop George Musser told me that there's two lines that come through Bishop Matthews. You just have to trace out which one is which, know who is valid and licit. I'm asking, which one of the multitude do they trace out? On page 201, Peter Anson tells us why Prince de Landis Burgess came to the United States. It reads, Prince Bishop de Landis Burgess, of whom Archbishop Matthews had had such high hopes, he had been forced to flee to the United States because he was an alien in danger of internment. So long as the war lasted, he would have to remain on the other side of the Atlantic. On pages 203 and 204, it gives some important information. It reads, on December 31st, he, Arnold Harris Matthew, added his signature to printed copies of an act of submission to His Holiness Pope Benedict XV and posted them to his friends. This three-page leaflet starts with the words, quote, having spent 2 months beginning from October 18th, 1915 in almost uninterrupted solitude and retreat, in order that I might devote much prayer and study to a careful reconsideration of the position I was induced in 1907 to adopt, in relation to a movement which appeared likely to help forward the return of our nation to the faith of our forefathers. It behooves me to inform my friends of the result of this period of serious contemplation, unquote. Having explained in detail how he had been brought back to a belief in the primacy of the Roman Pontiff as a successor of St. Peter and its fundamental importance, he went on, quote, when a man perceives clearly that he has blundered or been misled, it is his obvious duty, at no matter what sacrifice, to acknowledge the fact. This I am now doing by offering my contrition with humble, unconditional, and entire submission to His Holiness Pope Benedict XV. I have therefore sent my petition for absolution from censure and for restoration to the visible unity of the Church to His Eminence Cardinal Mary Duval, Prefect of the Holy Office, unquote. And here it gives a footnote. So sure was Matthew that he had, quote, come home, unquote, at long last, that he went to the expense of having a small notice printed stating that he had, quote, offered his unconditional humble submission to the Sovereign Pontiff, unquote. These slips were stuffed on the covers of copies of an Episcopal Odyssey sold between January 1st and March 13th, 1916. End of the footnote. Now back to the text and listen carefully, please. On January 8th, 1916, the following notice appeared in the tablet. I interrupt to state the tablet is a newspaper printed over there. Going on here, quote, the Reverend Arnold Harris Matthew, his submission to the Holy See has already been announced, writes to us with regard to his position as follows, quote, although the orders of the Dutch schismatical clergy were, down to 1910, undisputed in Rome, I'm interrupting the text here to ask why Matthew said they're only undisputed down to 1910, although he was consecrated in 1908. To draw and dispute them after 1910. Now listen to this next part, it's very important. This is what Matthew says. I make no claim to be regarded as a bishop, or to exercise episcopal functions, or to use any episcopal insignia. I desire to conform in everything to whatever may be the commands or wishes of the Holy See. Neither do I intend to claim even to exercise priestly functions, unless and until I earnestly hope this privilege may be permitted to me. It is my firm resolve, which nothing will ever alter, to obey the commands of the Holy Father, whose word I am freely willing to await, and I shall do nothing whatsoever, either publicly or privately, in any ecclesiastical matters without the permission of superiors. Unquote of what Matthew said, and unquote of what the tablet wrote. So now I simply comment, we have saying that Arnold Harris Matthew himself made no claim to be regarded as a bishop. But, as he went on to say, it is my firm resolve which nothing will ever alter. Read over here in the next page, 205. Evidently the terms proposed by Benedict XV, Cardinal Mary Duval, were not considered reasonable. The Archbishop, encouraged by his grand victor, came to the conclusion that it was his duty to revive the moribund remnant of the old Catholic Church in Great Britain and Ireland, which had not been perverted by theosophical heresies. On March 5, 1916, in order to prevent confusion with the schismatic clergy, he renamed his sect, quote, the Western Unionite Catholic Church, unquote. By the first Sunday in Lent in 1916, he had resumed his purple cassock and his archiepiscopal regalia. That, quote, firm resolve which nothing will ever alter, unquote, had lasted no more than 2 months. Even more incredible, considering all that he had said in the past about the invalidity of Anglican orders, and that more than once he had informed the Archbishop of Canterbury that the Church of England had no claim to be the Catholic Church in this country, and that his bishops were merely state officials, whilst he's writing to Dr. Davison to suggest that his little flock should become a sort of Anglican Unionite Church. With an equal lack of consistency, he made up his mind at the same time to raise Canon Williams to the episcopate. On page 206 it reads, on the feast of the Seven Sorrows of Our Lady, April 14th, 1916, Archbishop Matthew raised to the episcopate Bernard Mary Williams as his perpetual coadjutor with right of succession. further down this page, it tells about how he wrote to Dr. Davison. And Davison told Matthew, not mincing his words, that his, quote, relations successively to the Church of England, then to the Church of Rome, then to the Church of England again, then to the old Catholics, then to the Eastern Church, then to the independent organization under his headship, then to the Church of Rome again, and now to the Church of England again, unquote, gave, quote, a store of loyalties and disloyalties, unquote, which in his opinion was, quote, incompatible with any adequate sense of the responsibilities belonging to membership in an organized body which had Christ as its head, unquote. The parliament about England remarked that he could not, quote, in honesty refrain from pointing out, unquote, to Archbishop Matthew, quote, the position which men have been placed to have been ordained or consecrated by him, whether validly or invalidly, unquote. What was their position now? He reminded Matthew that he had proposed to consecrate at least 8 bishops, and that he had ordained many more men to the priesthood. He could not understand why this utterly irresponsible prelate had now written to him stating that he had decided to, quote, terminate the organization, unquote, and added, quote, is this a tolerable position to maintain? And so this shows us again how unstable and flexible Matthews was. Once again, it says here on page 210 that Matthews began to correspond with Dr. Davison, requesting permission to officiate in Anglican churches. And this book goes on to explain a number of things, but because we've heard the voice of Bishop Francis Shepard explaining how he can be so certain that the orders he receives are valid, let me read what Peter Anson writes here at the end in this chapter of Arnold Harris Matthew on page 214. Still regarding himself as an honorary prelate of the Order of Cooperate Reunion, an office he had accepted in 1912, Matthew accepted it as his duty to validate the orders of any Anglican clergyman who sought him out in his retreat at South Mimms. These candle-stained ceremonies conducted in the college included conditional baptism and confirmation. It was understood that no fee or reward of any description must be offered or would be accepted by the Archbishop for services rendered. How many secret ordinations were performed during the summer and autumn of 1919 is not known. The letters prove that early in December, a certain Anglican clergyman in the BEF was able to sail for the Far East with the feeling that he was, quote, a real priest, unquote. It is possible that Matthew performed another of these surreptitious ordinations on December 19th. He died suddenly the following day, the vigil of St. Thomas, the doubting apostle. Unlike Charles Maurice de Talleyrand, Bishop of Auden in 1838, Archbishop Arnold Harris Matthew had no Catholic niece at hand to call any priest before his death, so he never got the chance to make a solemn declaration which he openly disavowed, quote, the great errors which had troubled and afflicted the Catholic, Apostolic, and Roman Church, and in which he himself had had the misfortune to fall, unquote. As a would-be member of the established church, he was buried with Anglican rites near the south door of the village church. And Peter Anson closes this chapter of Matthews by writing, Matthew's episcopal seal, some documents and other papers also disappeared mysteriously shortly after. Thus, any document with his seal would not in itself be a proof of consecration or ordination. Nevertheless, there would seem to be sufficient evidence that 2 or 3 Anglican clergymen did receive the episcopate from his hands, though for obvious reasons they kept it secret. And yet, these are the so-called churches that kept the best records in the world. To me, that is another evident contradiction. But under this section, Churches of the Matthews Succession, Peter Anson tells us about 2 of these men that Matthews consecrated, named Leadbeater and Wedgwood. And after Leadbeater's consecration, which was carried out according to the Roman Rite, I ask you to note the Roman Rite, but sometimes in this book, the Roman Rite was the revised vernacular version. And when they used the Pontificale Romanum, Mr. Anson tells us that sometimes that was the English version of the Pontificale Romanum. But anyway, it says here, after Lee Beater's consecration, which was carried out according to the Roman Rite, the two bishops decided that a new liturgy was needed. Pisano tells that this Bishop Wedgwood, assisted by Lee Beater, consecrated the John Keir, Julian, Adrian, Mazzell as auxiliary bishop for Australia on the feast of St. John the Baptist, June 24, 1917. This was the last occasion that Matthew's old Catholic missal and ritual was used by the theosophical branch of his church. Take note here then that this Archbishop Arnold Harris Matthew wrote up his own old Catholic missal and ritual. Why did he have to write his own if he was going to follow the Pontificale Romanum? And in other words, did he perform the things according to the Pontificale Romanum enough to make it even a valid? Certainly it could not have been a licit ordination or a consecration. But some of the things about this Bishop Wedgwood and Lee Beater, who Arnold Harris Matthews consecrated, are these facts: that in 1918, Wedgwood gave his imprimatur to a small liturgical book containing a new version of the Roman Mass in the vernacular, also Vespers and Benediction. It was issued for the use of the churches of our movement in the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and America.